The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Mr. D. Mr. D was on 2 years ago, and this is not his debut. But some of you will know him from Academic Agent Stream. Some of you will know him from Twitter. But Mr. D, why don't you introduce yourself? I've described you as a British commentator and raconteur.
Well, I suppose that's quite a compliment. I'm more rack than raconteur, I'm afraid. But I'm John Dee. I enjoy long walks on the beach. I'm a Sagittarius. I'm looking for that special someone who's into lemon pastries and blues music. No, I am the co-host ostensibly of Academic Agents Unpopular Opinions. So people may have heard me there. I provide my services as a reliable irritant and court jester for the show, and I do things on Twitter. I've been doing these Twitter spaces for the past almost a year now. Tend to be late night, very long conversations with various friends and with various amounts of intoxication. So that's sort of my online presence. I don't have a channel. I don't produce YouTube videos. I don't produce content of that sort. By profession, I am a quote artist. I always hesitate to say it because it just has that ring of twattishness about it. But it is true. It is how I make my living and how I have done so for many years, and of course generally the arts, fine arts and culture tend to be my concerns, although again with this odd tangent that I've taken online, I also find myself commentating on current events and such and politics, so that is who I am.
Excellent. Well, I think last time we talked about art college an awful lot and the 90s, and I guess I do talk about the 90s an awful lot. I'll try not to do it this time. Art college, I always end up talking about that if the other person went to art college as well. It just seems to happen, but I like it to only happen once because I don't want to bore everyone. So, I mean, it's one of those things, I guess, is... You know, when you meet someone who's done the same thing as you once did, you inevitably want to share your experiences of it and your reflections on it. It's a natural enough thing. But since we did that the first time, why don't we talk about 2023 and these events? It generally ends up being a useful backbone for these streams. I asked the person, what did you think of this year? And the big events of it. And the big events of it are Elon Musk's Twitter, the Gaza conflict, and Ukraine sort of dwindling, that conflict. And I don't know, what else? Can you think of anything else from this year?
Boy, it's difficult. It's funny. I did a special midweek Twitter space last night with some friends, and including the Prudentialist, whom you've spoken to before, and we were doing a recap and going through sort of major events of 2023, and again both sort of marveling at how sort of distant like things that happened just 12 months ago seem, and how sort of like things just sort of they flash and then they fade away like a like a burst of flame in the darkness, you know, and they dwindle so quickly and then fade into memory, you know, and of course things seem to accelerate, have accelerated so much in that way. But I mean, 2023, I feel like I just have this odd sensation that we're approaching something. I mean, some sort of something is going to give. It just feels like, you know, a year of kind of flux, a year of kind of, you know, a kind of cross, you know, toward the end of crossing some sort of Rubicon or other. And so there is a sort of odd feeling that I've had, and certainly the events that you mentioned and other things that have happened seem to indicate that that something is going to give way and some sort of change or new direction in sort of world events is going to come. I'm trying to avoid using the terrible phrase paradigm shift because I hate it so much. But you know, for lack of any better descriptor.
Other people have said vibe shift. I imagine vibe shift. I'm not comfy with that either.
Well, it's better because as Prudentialist likes to say, you know, no apocalypse, just vibes, you know. So
well, I'll tell you what, it's interesting what you say about something can seem so big and important at the time, and everyone's talking about it, and then 6 months later, no one can remember it. You know, something that nobody has mentioned on Millennial this year so far? The Titanic sub thing.
Yes.
And that was for about a week. No one would shut up about that.
Yeah. That came and went like an explosive decompression, didn't it? A bit dark.
So that's somewhat similar, yes.
Too soon. Yeah, but it is. I mean, it is these just endless cycles where, you know, certainly in the online space, it's like hungry dogs grabbing fighting over a ham bone, you know, that's and then which they toss around and gnaw to pieces, and then it's all over, you know, and that's sort of what these things feel like. It's just this throwing chum into a pool of piranhas, and you get that burst of activity, and then all is silent. So I don't know. I mean, and I wonder, of course, there's always, you know, being old, you know, ancient, I of course occasionally feel like, well, maybe this is just, you know, I mean, I will say that there is a sort of dilation of time, actually not so much dilation as shrinkage of time as one becomes older, you know. Time seems to accelerate, time seems to go faster, and so I'm just like, well, maybe this is just the sort of consequence of becoming ancient, that, you know, that things seem to pass by so quickly, time seems to pass by so quickly. But I just hear too many other people talking about how things just seem to come and go, and you know, there's just these endless feeding cycles of you know, content creation and news and people trying to get the best takes in.
It's definitely a thing. And I remember when the Iraq war happened and the BBC did what was called, and I'm sure all the other news channels did it as well, they did what was called rolling coverage. And I remember them saying at the time, this is the first war where there's been rolling coverage. And I don't really know what the technological leap was that enabled this, or exactly what it was, how it differed from previous coverage. But I think it was that there were digital channels by then, so there was BBC News 24 or whatever. So it was just constantly, like a website, it was just constantly updating. So It wouldn't be that you'd have to wait for the 6 o'clock news to hear that that city had been bombed. You would hear about it as soon as it happened, which, I mean, you can question whether it's worth knowing. Do you really need to know as soon as it's happened? Nowadays, 20 years on, the reason you need to know as soon as it's happened is that there's a whole social media frenzy going on about it immediately, which will be all over by the time the 6 o'clock news rolls around.
Indeed, you know, and I mean, it's odd because the first sort of world events where I was cognizant of the, so I was online quite early, you know, I dabbled in very early when it was BBS, bulletin board systems, and that sort of thing. And then I sort of became a Luddite for quite a number of years and didn't return to the internet until the kind of late 90s. But the first event I recall following online rather than through newspapers or, you know, I never watched like newsreaders or anything. So, but the first event was September 11th, 2001. I was living in America at the time, where I had moved in the late 90s to pursue various things, including educational concerns and such. And so that event I sort of experienced mostly through online media. And of course, it was very different. It was being online was very different in 2001, obviously, for people who can remember it. But yes, and of course, you know, this idea that everything was, there was a constant presence, everything existed in a single moment. There wasn't this sense that, of course, you had the recap of what happened yesterday, what happened, you know, earlier this morning. You know, you were seeing things, live updates. And I suppose that's what, they mean. But I feel like that happened far, you know, quite a number of years earlier than the coming of the Iraq War, sort of veering it to relating that to the arts. I remember the first Gulf War in the early 1990s. There is a British artist who you probably know, people out there, I mean, if you're all familiar with art history, named Richard Hamilton, who was sort of one of the early kind of British pop artists. But he did a series of paintings, one which I actually posted on my, occasionally post art on Twitter, like art that I'm just interested in getting before people's eyes. But I posted one of those pictures, and it was basically a sort of an early inkjet print on canvas, which he had then manipulated with oil paint. But it was a photograph of his television. And there was, of course, like toy tanks on the screen, and it was referencing kind of the way that war was televised, you know. And this was, you know, as I said, 1990, maybe 1991, something like that. So, so I think this sort of new paradigm, this new vibe of the way events are presented and consumed, has been building for a long time. It's just, again, it's the pace of the acceleration of these technologies, which has changed. But being old, I remember sort of the advent of this world that we live in now, you know, and how different it was and how odd it was.
Photo of a TV showing an,
yes,
so yeah, the photo had been inkjet printed, and then he had painted over it with oil.
Yeah, so it was, and again, back in 1990-91, I mean, it was very early days of producing art. I mean, now, you know, I mean, people have been doing that sort of thing for years now, but it was sort of early example of that. It was, you know, not a, you know, a fairly large picture, but yes, it was basically a kind of photograph of a television, you know, and a hi-fi and some cabinets and a plant. I'm recalling it from memory. And then, of course, the image was like, I don't remember if it was BBC like coverage or CNN coverage on the TV of the first Gulf War, but yes. And then he had painted in with oils, sort of turning, there was a sort of array of tanks, and they were sort of painted in primary colors, and then there's sort of blood running out of the TV screen. I mean, you know, a bit over the top, but you know, it was certainly, I mean, as Richard Hamilton had done with a lot of his post 1960s work, and it was more of a comment upon mediation, you know, upon and how mediation had, how mediation had changed the way that people live their lives and think about, you know, and think about war and think about, all of these ancient things that are part of the human experience. I am a technological skeptic in a lot of ways. Even though I'm aware that, you know, we all live in, if you're a technological skeptic, you tend to live in hypocrisy, of course, because you're also inextricably immersed in that world, even if you don't want to be. But I tend to see, of course, the kind of dark side, the tragic side of what living in media and living in fiction has done to the human mind and to human culture. And I do think that some of a lot of the problems that we sort of discuss, you know, in these spaces are kind of psychological trauma of humans trying to adjust to post-human, to inhuman ways of being, you know, because I think so,
yeah, because we're getting to grips, we're trying to get to grips with the fact that we live with the media, but the media isn't real life, it isn't reality, it isn't a pebble in your hand, it isn't something tangible, and yet we believe in it so fervently, it defines our existence, it defines how we see the world, how we think about life, and even how we think about other people, how we think about ourselves. Locations and storylines and characters that we know from the media aren't real. And I think this continues to baffle me. And I imagine it's similar for other people. This line between, you know, fact and fiction is difficult to keep believing in that divide when it all feels so real.
Yes, and of course, you know, I mean, we also, I mean, we know, or I won't say we know. I mean, we assume that, of course, somewhere on the other side of the picture, somewhere on the other side of the mediation, is the real. You know, you mentioned the events in Gaza or the conflict in Ukraine. People are, of course. Both of those events, like everything else, it's people online and otherwise feel that they must become incredibly invested, you know, that this is a narrative which, you know, I must adjust to, I must incorporate into my life, I must incorporate into my thought patterns. And again, we assume. And we you know, and of course, part of the way it works is that we, you know, we feel confident to assert that, of course, on the other side of this fiction or on the other side of this mediation, you know, there is real suffering, there are real issues that people are talking about. But of course, for most people, these things are meaningless. These things, you know, these things have no real reference in people's lives at all, and this was something we talked about a couple of days ago on Unpopular Opinions. You know, Academic Agent was making the point that, you know, of course, and the correct point, I think that it optically, you know, narratively, the state of Israel is not particularly looking good. In the current conflict and in the way the current conflict is being presented. But, you know, my contention, of course, is that either way, I am not fundamentally swayed into this narrative space because it doesn't concern me. And of course, that sounds, you know, well, it's selfish, you know, the jaded, the callous Gen X, you know, I don't care. But I think if a lot of people, if they sort of examine what is your relationship, what is your stake in these situations, whether it be Gaza, whether it be Ukraine, whether it be the Titanic sub, you know, whether it be, you know, any insert topic here, you know, how are you being led into something which is no concern at all in your own life, in your own culture, in your own street, in your own house, you know?
Well,
I think people get led astray.
Oh yeah, I mean, something that was said about COVID was that if it weren't on the TV that there was a plague, nobody would even know that there was anything unusual going on.
Nope, hardly anyone would have noticed. No.
Well, some people would have said there was a nasty bug going around, and some people wouldn't even have said that.
No, I absolutely not. But again, it shows the power that it, you know, that this situation became real because it was willed into reality by various forces for various reasons, you know. And then, of course, everyone must align themselves to it as if it is real, as if it is present in their own life. And of course, for some people it was, and for most people it wasn't. It had really no effect on them. And without that vast narrative, it would have passed by, you know. And of course, it also shows how, you know, these seemingly fictive or seemingly media driven narratives can become terribly real, and of course have devastating consequences on people's lives. You know, so they can become, you know, I mean, you may have nothing to do with events in Gaza, but in one way or the other, when you become enmeshed in this structure of narrative, you know, that it can become real very fast in a weird way that has nothing to do with the, you know, with the origins of a conflict on the other side of the world. So it is very odd, you know. And of course, as time goes on and generation after generation comes, there is less contact with the world as it used to be. There's less sort of cognizance that this is different. This is not the way things were. And of course, this is the source of pain, you know, for as one generation passes into the next, and probably always has been, because of course, you know, as you age, you realize that you were witness to a world that, you know, the people who come after you will have no memory and no concern about it at all, and they will go off in their own way, in their own picture of the world.
It's depressing, isn't it? The things that matter so much to us, that mean so much to us, will be alien and foreign and meaningless to those who come after us. It really is. It's a sad thing. I think this is already, I mean, you see this with generational differences, you know, where the Zoomers simply don't know about the world that we grew up in. You know, they don't, it means nothing to them. And I guess it's quite right, because, you know, the 60s didn't mean anything to me when I was younger.
Yeah, I certainly did not have an average upbringing in childhood. But you know, for me, I mean, I was extraordinarily connected to the kind of world of the past, which, of course, at times seemed more real to me than what was happening around me. You know, like for me, I've always had a sense of the past being very much alive in a certain way. I've always felt and always been able to sort of feel the kind of resonance of the past. I mean, this goes back to the kind of Burkean contract, you know, that there is that those who have died and those who are yet to be born are linked by those who are living, you know, that there is this chain from the past to the future. And that is very important. And of course, you know, that is a kind of basis of what, you know, what would be called conservatism, you know, what would be called the proper kind of hierarchy of past and present. But of course, this has been eroded, and modern, you know, the modern condition has eroded this and has been doing so for years. You know, I mean, now we've created this entire class, you know, we created the TM. People have heard this concept that the teenager was a construction of the 20th century, and the construction of marketing and media for the most part. And so we've created this class of people. And of course, we operate very much now on this idea that rather than linking, rather than those who are alive linking the past to the future, everything is a conflict. You know, it's a constant Bolshevik revolution that must happen from generation to generation. You must slay your parents, you must slay your ancestors, you're against them, you're against the old, you know. And we see it, of course, in online culture, you know, calling everyone boomers, you know, oh well, you know, the day of the pillow is going to come. And certainly I understand, because the boomers being one of the worst generations of people who were ever born, in certain ways, but also there is something deeply caustic and anti-hierarchical and anti-traditional to this idea that we now must raise the past rather than embrace it and link it to those who will come after us. And I think that rupture is another thing that causes the kind of psychotic break that we see happening in human civilization today.
I wonder if it's because life, you know, culture, society changes so fast now that the world of our parents and grandparents does seem so alien to us. Then again, having had that thought, it then occurred to me, well, what about someone in the 15th century? Would their grandparents' life really have seemed the same as theirs, or would they have, in at a different scale, nonetheless thought that, well, his life seems very different from mine? I really don't know. Maybe then they would focus on the tiny differences. I honestly don't know. And this is annoying because it's the kind of question that you can't ask it. There's no, we can't ask them. We can't interrogate them on this, you know, people from the past. But I do think that, life does change very fast now. I mean, even in the last 20 years, society has changed hugely. In ways that I don't think you wouldn't really get someone from 2003 to believe certain things about 2023. And I think in that sense, and certainly 1953 and so on. So our grandparents, they did have very different lives. I mean, you only have to look at photos and you realize, bloody hell, it's the ways that people interacted, the way that they dressed, the way that they looked, the manners, the way they spoke, everything was radically different from today. And so I think it's quite natural that we do feel quite distant from all of that. But I also take the point that you're saying that the past is there. It is all around us. It's almost in the air. But we don't speak its language anymore.
I think there's truth to that. Although, weirdly enough, I think we are more surrounded by, we have more past now than people in the 15th century or the 17th century or even the 19th century, because we're surrounded by residue of past in the way that people who came before us weren't. You know, I mean, in a way, our culture, modern human culture, civilization is haunted, like absolutely chock-a-block full of ghosts and phantoms and residues of the past. I mean, and I'm talking specifically about certainly the advent of photography, the advent of audio recording, the advent of film, the advent of video, and of course the promulgation of these technologies, and of course the spread of them to almost every single person on Earth, certainly every single person in the West. You know, I mean, within, you know, I remember 2007, I remember 1997, I remember very specifically, you know, very clearly, because it wasn't that long ago for someone like me. But you think about 2005, very few people had, certainly no one had a smartphone. People didn't carry around things that had a camera in it. And now, of course, people carry, almost everyone has a device which is capable of taking high definition, high resolution video. And so the amount of media, the amount of recordings and videos and photographs in the world is, it's just exponentially gigantic compared to even 20 years ago. It's not to mention 200 years ago. You know, I mean, you know, in the past, certainly before the advent of these storage technologies, in a weird way, the ability to store a residue of something that happened and watch it again and visit again. No one had it. You know, when people died, their voices died with them. You know, their face, other than if they had a portrait. But that's, you know, again, it's a step removed. So people existed, the people who had passed and events in the past, memories, existed only in the human mind, or if they were written down. You know, again, a few steps removed. But now, you know, we can hear echoes of the 1920s, the 30s, the 60s, the 80s, whatever, any moment, all of these millions who have passed on in the modern age, many of them can be recalled at the touch of a button, at the fingertip. And I think there is something, again, deeply unsettling in a way about this.
See, this might be why we have this appetite for... We kind of expect it now that everything is recorded. And so it's weird that, it's recorded, but I'm not there. I can see the 30s, but I'm not there. And I really don't know what it felt like to stand on that street in 1935 or whatever. It really is a different world. And it's not a world that I would even belong in if I were to be teleported back there. Even though I can see it right in front of me in color, maybe a recording of the audio as well, so I can hear it, but it's still not my world. I think this is a very strange, because again, in the past, this simply didn't happen. Nobody was bothered by the past in the way that we are now. And I'll tell you what, I've been doing this research thing into the loony left in the 80s, and a thought that occurred to me. And I've actually written a separate essay about doing this project. And this is one of the things I say in that essay. A lot of stuff, when you're doing a historical research project, it's alarming how much just it wasn't recorded. So for example, there's a guy that I was researching. He lived in London in mid-80s. And he seemed to, every newspaper article about him lists a different, gives a different address. So he was constantly moving around. And there's nowhere that lists that. There's nowhere, I cannot find where he was living. There's no sort of formal list. Well, he moved from Camden to Islington on the 5th of June, 85. You know, it's not there. But nowadays, it's much more likely that that kind of stuff actually could be discerned. If not listed tidily, you could look through his Facebook and or even his Twitter or his Instagram and find out pretty much exactly when he moved from A to B. I mean, it's incredible when you think about it. But things like that, the facts about life like that didn't get recorded. There's nowhere to... No one knows. I mean, maybe it's in a government vault somewhere that he was paying tax from this address and then later that. Who knows? But probably not. Probably that data will have been deleted long ago. And in any case, it would never be accessible to the public. But then you've also got photos, video. As you said, nowadays, everyone is taking photos all the time. So we tend to assume that, well, there will be photos of this event from 1987, right? And then you realise, actually, no, there probably wouldn't be because no one had phones then. No one had digital cameras then. Hardly anyone had camcorders then, except, you know, some father with midlife crisis kind of thing, you know. But other than that, no one had this. So there don't exist the records of everyday life that we are now busily compiling. And I wonder how much of this will actually survive in the future. It doesn't take much to save a photo, to save 1,000 copies of a photo in different locations around the world. You could do it easily enough. But so much of it is ephemeral, of course. Like, it's trivial, a better word to use. But I think my point is that it's so omnipresent now that we tend to, or I tend to naturally assume that it's just a sort of effortless subconscious assumption that it's always been like this. So there will be photos of X and Y from 1992 or whatever. And then you find out that, no, there just aren't. And it's kind of like a loss. It feels like, oh, shit, I would love to have seen that event. I would love to have seen that person. They're the only time those two people met. And there's no record of it. There's no photo to show that it happened. And to see how they looked at each other, how they stood, you know. Nothing. I don't know what point I'm making here, really, other than things have changed. And these recording technologies really are very recent. It's the last 10 years, 15 years. But that's long enough, even for me. I mean, I'm 40, so it's not like I'm a teenager growing up in this. But it's even affected my expectations of technology and so on. I tend to assume that it was always like this, even though within my lifetime, well within my lifetime, it wasn't like this. I don't know. Is this just me? Is this some sort of hang up on my part?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I think you're sort of hitting at the heart of it. I mean, it's very difficult put into words this strange feeling, which is why, you know, I mean, I think one of the reasons why I'm so attracted to this idea of calling this phenomenon, sort of linking this phenomenon to the idea of ghosts, you know, again, a ghost, it's generally not a, you know, not a clear manifestation. It's something, you know, it's a half record. It's a fuzzy imprint of something that was once real. And so it's very difficult to kind of figure out what exactly makes everything about this feel so strange. I've thought of a couple of things while we were talking, you know, about the idea of you know, sort of memory. I mean, how the past was kept. I mean, I don't know a lot about this system, but there was something called the tally stick. Which was used, it really started in the Middle Ages. I mean, this form of kind of notation in the way it was used in Britain, it was a tool of accounting. I mean, originally it was records of taxes paid. It was basically making these marks on these wooden sticks.
And what was it called?
They were called tally sticks, T-A-L-L-Y. Tally sticks, and evolved into you know, it was basically these sticks which had kind of nicks, marks put in them that were ways again of recording financial transactions, often how much tax had been paid, and it was sort of a sign of a kind of financial shorthand that was really used in Britain from the Middle Ages. So this was again carried on for hundreds of years. I mean, that, and again, I don't know a lot about how these were used in a financial sense, because I'm, you know, I'm from the humanities, but, you know, it evolved into a weird form of kind of currency keeping. And there's a sort of link from this system to the way that kind of modern banking transactions happen, that people can look into it. The thing that I find interesting, of course, is that these things were physical objects. These were like literally wooden sticks. And over the centuries, the British government accumulated thousands and thousands and thousands, vast stores of these sticks. And of course, by the beginning of the 19th century, you know, these were not, this system had been modernized, was not used anymore, but they still had basically 6 centuries worth of these wooden sticks, and many of them were stored under the Houses of Parliament. They were stored other places as well, and so I think in the early 19th century they decided that they were going to get rid of these, and that they were going to burn them in the furnaces beneath the Houses of Parliament. six centuries worth of these sticks, which of course were notations, records of the past. And so they commenced burning them, but it was so much, and of course it went on so long that the chimneys caught fire, and eventually it burnt the entire Houses of Parliament. People will remember the burning of the Houses of Parliament. Turner did some famous paintings and watercolor sketches of the burning of the Houses of Parliament in the early 19th century. So, I mean, it's always struck me as strange that, again, this moment where hundreds of years of this, again, record notation of, even though it was just financial information, still, that the destruction of this caused a conflagration that literally destroyed the House of Parliament. It was the burning of these tally sticks that was the proximate cause of that fire. So there is always something, I mean, metaphorically curious about that to me, this destruction of memory. And this is something many artists have dealt with, what is the past? How do, even of course now in modern age, like how do you reconstruct a moment from media, what do you believe, And now, of course, with so-called AI, I mean, people know that I have big problems with the way that AI, that AI is marketed. I don't think it's probably called intelligent, but everyone knows, of course, that now we have fairly sophisticated neural network and capabilities to produce images, sounds. I mean, we can literally perform a digital seance and get the voice of a person who has died to say things that they'd never said in life. And so, of course, I think the wise people have always understood that human memory and even media that we can see, a photographic memory, a photographic record, even those things should never entirely be believed, because there is always some doubt. There is always a question of subjectivity, a question of fictionalization. So I've always been drawn to like works of art, or sort of cultural works that deal with these questions. Two works I wanted to bring up specifically. One of them, of course, is a film by Akira Kurosawa from 1950 called Rashomon, or known as Rashomon. Have you ever seen Rashomon?
I'm afraid not. I don't think I've seen any of Akira Kurosawa's films.
Oh well, if you're interested in watching some wonderful films, you've got some great times ahead of you. Absolute masterpieces in his repertoire. Rashomon being one of them. Rashomon, the film is centered around a plot device in which various characters are telling the story of a specific incident, specific actions of characters. But of course, it is told through these characters' subjective experience. And you see events almost retold, sort of identically played out, except of course they're not identical at all. And you're led to, I think the final philosophical question of this is, where is the real? Where is the truth? Where does it lie? And of course, in a way, it doesn't lie anywhere. You can't ever reconstruct the past. You can't ever really get to the truth. You can get closer to it or further away from it, but everything, even things that we think are completely objective, like photographs, like film, are a kind of subjectivity. The truth is something that you can only approach. It's like a black hole. You will endlessly approach it, but to the person perceiving it, you will never actually cross that event horizon. So it's always been a very interesting idea to me, and it's something that again is very famously done in Rashomon. The final sort of work that I've been thinking about lately is also related to Japan, but from a Western, told from a Western perspective, is a musical that was produced in 1975. I may have the date slightly wrong. It was written by Stephen Sondheim, and it's called Pacific Overtures. The show is about the first contact between Japan and the West, which occurred in the 19th century, and about, again, how this contact changed both the West who made contact and certainly the Japanese. But there is a scene that happens in this show, where there is a meeting. Now, and then of course this actually happened, like all of the sort of events in the show, or at least the historical events presented in the show, are all kind of well-known historical events that happened in Japan during this period. The song is called Someone in a Tree, and it's about this meeting that occurred between the Japanese and the Westerners, Commodore Perry and such. And there's this kind of all kind of lead up to this in the show, where the Japanese were trying to figure out how do we get them. We don't want them to actually. No foreigner can set foot on the sacred shores of Japan, and so the solution was to put down a bunch of rush matting so their feet actually aren't touching the beach. So they build these sort of rush mat, pathways to a place that they built called the Treaty House, a temporary building where they could work out this treaty in the terms of basically the treaty between the Japanese and the Westerners, in a bid to keep Perry from, literally invading. And what is interesting, of course, is that Sondheim and the gentleman who wrote the book for the show, whose name eludes me at the moment, but they made the centerpiece of the show this treaty, this meeting. But of course, there is no historical record of what actually happened at the meeting. There is, of course, all kinds of history about the lead up to this and how it actually happened. But there is no record of what was said inside. No, there were no notes taken. There was no sort of transcript of anything that happened. And so, of course, it's very interesting to kind of make the center of your show about history. And I think one of the themes of the show is this idea of history. How is history constructed? What does history mean? But of course, the central moment is unknown. We will never know. It passed into oblivion without any kind of residue. And so, of course, there's this wonderful song about subjectivities, and it's told from a young boy who was a young boy at the time that this actually happened, and he climbed a tree from the distance and watched, of course, all the officials come off the boats and all the Japanese officials go into the treaty house. Like, he watched it from a distance, from a tree. And then, of course, he is also appearing as his old self, remembering this moment. And then there is a third party who is a samurai who was stationed beneath the treaty house in case the Westerners pulled any sort of trick. Then he was meant to spring up and, of course, defend the Japanese officials, but nothing happened. And so he remained under the floorboards, and he couldn't quite hear it. He just heard people walking around. He heard people shouting, but he didn't really hear it. And of course, the whole song is a kind of back and forth between the old man and his younger self and this samurai. And then the reciter, the narrator of the show, about what actually happened. Of course, the whole song is nothing happened. People came and went. People shouted. People walked around. They sipped tea. But this central moment is unknown, is blank. And I do think this is a problem that artists deal with, and certainly most people who really kind of examine how they live in the modern moment have to come to terms with, And we think that, of course, technology renders these questions moot, But I don't think it does. I think it actually makes everything more ambiguous.
Quantity of recording that's now possible, whenever there is a gap, it's all the more glaring. It's all the more painful because it could so easily have been recorded.
Yeah, indeed. So I certainly urge people. There is actually a recording of the original cast of Pacific Overtures. At least there was. I haven't checked for a while, but you can watch it on YouTube free. And if you're very interested in Meiji, in Japan of this period, it's a wonderful show. So I'm not a big musical person. You know, I'm not a big fan of music, but I love Stephen Sondheim. So
that's unusual for a homosexual.
Well, thank you, Wosie. I appreciate it. Good Lord.
I thought, should I say that or is it too awkward?
Oh, my God. Okay. For those who don't know me, who are shocked by that revelation, I am the world's most homophobic homosexual.
homophobic that he doesn't like musicals.
God, I hate musicals. No, I don't. It's not a form that ever appealed to me. I'm a lifelong appreciator of Baroque music, classical music, early music, medieval music. But I've never been a big fan of most vocal music. I'm not a fan of most opera either. Fan. I always try to avoid using the word fan because I don't like it. It seems a bit vulgar, but. What's the meme word? Enjoyer. I'm not an opera enjoyer.
A regarder.
A regarder, yeah.
I'm trying to think of musicals that I do like. And there is one, but I can't think what it is. There's one that I realized, that film's actually a musical. And I don't mind it. But I can't think. Fuck, that's really annoying. That's really annoying. But yeah, I don't like musicals really. I mean, I understand it's a genre, it's a thing, and I understand why people get into it.
It's a bit like another thing. I don't really like free jazz. I'm not a big enjoyer of any sort of jazz. I do like certain kind of big band things from the 1930s, 40s, but there's always, again, transcendent examples. It's one thing to sort of appreciate a genre or appreciate a style or a type, but it's another thing to just appreciate things that rise above their genre, that rise above the kind of particular form that they take, and they go into into the strata of great art. I mean, this is why, of course, my own particular practice as an artist is more related to painting and sculpture and such. But I think that there is a moment where, that works are so great and so much genius and so many facets that they sort of rise above their categorization, again, you don't have to be a film buff to appreciate, something like 2001 A Space Odyssey. You don't have to be a kind of fan of musicals to appreciate, Pacific Overtures or these things.
I'll tell you a film that's drawn that. I mean, I don't like it nowadays, obviously, but Cabaret.
Yes.
And that's actually a musical. And I remember that might be the film that's in my head that I'm thinking of where I realized many years later, that's actually a musical because it's integrated in the film. I don't know what the stage show was like, but the film with Liza Minnelli, it's the songs are integrated into it so that it's not too glaring. It's all happening at the Kitty Cat Club. So, well, and then also Tomorrow Belongs to Me. That's an exception.
That's good. I'm going to start singing it, but I shan't. No, I shan't.
Please don't.
Absolute banger. Absolute banger tune. Yes.
I'll try to join in, but I've only had a few Coca-Colas,
Yeah, I'm having my 20th coffee of the day, so I'm really wired. But strangely enough, of course, Cabaret, 1972, directed by Bob Fosse, who was probably the only heterosexual choreographer ever in the history of Broadway musical. But he also directed that film, and it's absolutely wonderful. I certainly recommend that as well. I mean, you know, if it, I mean, you can almost, I'm not going to make the based Cabaret case, but it could certainly be viewed as a morality play about Weimar. And of course, the inevitable consequences of that terrible period. As so much of the art, I mean, art from that period as well, you know, Otto Dix and other kind of painters, you know, who really kind of nakedly depicted the terribly ugly truth of that era. And of course, Cabaret was actually based upon Christopher Isherwood's I Am the Camera, which is a work that written around the period he lived in Weimar, Germany. Mm-hmm.
So
there is a connection there. So it's very interesting, and it's certainly got some wonderful moments. But yes, all the music in that, all the musical people don't just break out and sing. Like when they sing, it sort of makes sense in terms of the diegetic reality of moment. You know, that they sing because they're at a beer garden, or they're singing because they're on stage. No one like it just starts singing in the street.
Exactly. Exactly. So it makes sense within the story. But yeah, I mean, it's a long time since I saw that film. And I suspect nowadays it would just annoy me. That was one of those films that made a mark on my parents' generation. Mm. And so they would mention it now and then. Yeah, they were born in the early 50s. So they saw it when they were in their early 20s. And they knew of it and so on. So they'd mention it now and then. That's how I saw it. But, I mean, Liza Minnelli, that's a whole thing there. I'll tell you a funny story. I've never told this one. But it's not that funny. Don't get your hopes up. But it's amusing to me. I was listening to a bunch of gay guys talking about Liza Minnelli. And one of them, they were talking about her marriage, this dysfunctional marriage to some guy. I've forgotten who
his
guy was.
His name was David Guest.
I've realized it wasn't Liza Minnelli. It was her mother.
Oh, Judy Garland. Yes,
Judy Garland. And
even
and
worse.
Her dysfunctional marriage with some guy. And one of these gay guys said, what was their home life like? And this other gay guy said, and he was American, and he said, well, they'd fuck, and then he'd beat her up, and then they'd fuck some more. What a wonderful summary.
I mean, you know, that, and that, of course, would be some people's ideal marriage, I suppose. But, I mean, no, Judy Garland was an absolute wreck. I mean, absolute disaster, you know. I mean, it's quite a sad story what happened to her. I mean, she was sort of one of the early examples of a child star who was absolutely ruined by the demons in Hollywood. She really was, and turned into just the most pathetic drug addict, and died quite young. Yes, and had disastrous marriages. One of whom, which she married an open homosexual as well. So,
oh yes. No. Yes, I heard about it. I can't remember his name, but yeah.
Yeah, I can't either. But
it's a perennial thing, isn't it, with child stars, that they end up mad. Actually, Macaulay Culkin seems to be just about the only one who seems okay. I don't really know why.
Well, it was a hell of a hard road for him. I mean, I think he managed to survive, but... If you look into it, I mean, I'm not a big expert, but you know. But again, I mean, I mean that quite literally. When you put your child in the hands of Moloch, then it's not gonna turn out well.
No. I guess that brings us to the matter of Hollywood. I am curious, because this has come up several times on Millennial. I'm curious what you think about the longevity of Hollywood at this point. Do you think it's dying?
I think it's certainly on its last legs in a certain way. Yeah. I think it's going to have to change radically if it's going to survive at all. But the old model is gone. I'm afraid.
Why do you think that is? Is it that people have switched to episodic stuff?
Changing audiences and expectations. Changing.
Just before you go, I'll say this. I do actually think that the form of the 90-minute film, the feature film, I think it's going out. I think that people prefer long-running episodic stuff. But then you've got all the problems with the industry as well and the production methods, which, yeah, do seem to be unsustainable. But you take it away.
I think you're right. But I do think that, of course, just audience expectations and technological situation has caused the methods and the materials have to sort of shift. Unfortunately, something has come up, and I'm afraid that I must depart. I really apologize, but I'm sort of
It's all right. It's okay. You told me before. I maybe should have said that to the audience before when I started this. But Mr. D is dealing with nothing sinister. Don't worry. But he did say that something might come up that he'd have to deal with. So
yeah.
Well, nonetheless, you have appeared on Millennial this year, so thank you. And it's been a good hour, a very interesting conversation. So it does actually quite make me nostalgic for art college, I've got to say, whenever I talk to you.
Well, I suppose that's a good thing. So, anyway, sincere apologies for having to depart. But yes, I'm dealing with some personal circumstances that require my attention. So. But it's wonderful to be asked, and I wish we could have continued our conversation longer.
Don't worry about it. Always an
honor to be here.
Thank you. We'll keep it short and sweet, and it's been a nice hour. So thank you very much, Mr. D, for appearing on Millennial. I'll be back in a little while with the Winter Solstice AMA. But in the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated.
All aboard.
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.